Hello and welcome to our weekly podcast of Who's Here in the Hamptons. I'm Dan Rettiner, your host, broadcasting from my home in the Hamptons, where I have lived for over 55 years. I've written a dozen books about this glorious place, and I've seen it grow through the years from small tourist towns, quaint fishing villages, and a summer playground for high society, to what it is today, a world-class resort for celebrities, artists, musicians, authors, and billionaires. In my podcast, I will bring you interviews with not only these people, but also prominent local people who have helped shape the Hamptons. Welcome to Dan's Talks. My guest today is Daniel Edward Rosen, a journalist and author who's written an account called The Keeper of the Inn, actually The Keepers of the Inn. It's about the Mafia and Montauk. And I couldn't have thought of something better than that for a podcast in Dan's papers. Anyway, for starters, tell me a little bit about yourself. You told me earlier that you're a writer for several different publications and media. Which ones are they, and where did you get training? We'll do this quick.
Of course, sir. First and foremost, great to be here. Thank you for having me. So, yeah, I used to be with Newsday, Daily News, New York Post, New York Observer, and currently I'm a contributing writer for both New York Sun and City Journal. And I cover the FBI primarily, which is how this idea had come about.
Interested in the FBI. What did you, were you fascinated? Did you go to college and all that?
No, it kind of, I had, funnily enough, it was through, when I was at the Post, I had done a story about this building superintendent who had been arrested for stealing jewelry and money from his tenants. And I had interviewed him in prison. This is like 2011. And it turned out that he was, in fact, an FBI informant. And he had been working them for years. And so I had met through him, his former handler, and a bunch of other FBI agents. And so over time, you know, we kept in touch. I was a marketing executive for a bit. And I had been working on this project about the FBI in Brooklyn and Queens in the 70s and 80s, really on the merit of this con man who made the introduction. But it was, through them, I came across the story.
Well, the story is, I remember the story. I've been around for a long time. Mm-hmm. And the story is about a famous meeting that took place by the Mafia, I guess, to discuss further how they're going to cut up the pie, you know, and between themselves and have a good time doing that without shooting each other. And when it occurred, in Montauk, people knew about it. They knew about it after it, that this confab was taking place. And I'll tell you their reaction to it after you finish describing what happened that weekend in mm-hmm. Montauk.
Well, the funny thing is that it didn't happen when the FBI was there. And, you know, so to kind of get back to I have some questions for you about that. So basically in 1979, the Bureau had just opened a field office in Brooklyn, Queens, and it was predominantly staffed by New Yorkers, and they dealt a lot with organized crime cases. And so one agent, a man named Dennis Buckley, he had one of the few top echelon informants, guys who basically were very high ranking in a particular family. This particular informant was a member of the Genovese, and he had a very good relationship with Paul Castellano, who's the head of the Gambinos. And so Mr. Buckley's informant told him that there was going to be a big confab, as he said. A lot of guys were coming in from out of town, and was going to be taking place at Nick Monty's, at Gurney's. And so,
for those unfamiliar with it, mm-hmm. in Montauk, right up on the cliff facing out onto the ocean, been there for 100 years.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And so, and Nick Monty, And I've, the beauty of this day and age is I'm able to go do an extensive clip search, and I've certainly read the stories you wrote about him in the 70s and 80s. But with, Nick Monte was just kind of this larger than life character, as you've covered, who pretty much had an outsized impact on Montauk and making the Montauk sort of the evolution of Montauk as a destination. And so, but he had also owned a restaurant in Carroll Gardens called Monte's Venetian, which was, very popular with both New York politicians, mobsters, athletes, the Rat Pack. And so the FBI, they connected with a few other of their top level informants, and they were basically said, yeah, we've heard that there may be a meeting taking place at Gurney's on the week of September 14th or whatever it was. And so in their earnestness, they decided, okay, well, this is like Appalachian, which is the famous meeting in the 50s where every high ranking mobster was meeting in upstate New York. It's like that, except we have advanced knowledge of it. And so in their earnestness, they realized let's get as many routes as we can. Let's get agents there posing as undercovers, and let's get surveillance out there, and we'll just be eyes on the ground and wait for these mafiosos to arrive and check in. And then they can just effectively record whatever conversations they have, which to them would be worth its weight in gold in terms of establishing the conspiracy and eventually using RICO to go after the family.
And the FBI, and were they in costume, or did they present themselves and checking in as what did they?
They didn't wear a suit and ties. No, they wore. We have the photos up on our site on the story, but Bob Shortle, who's kind of like this, handsome agent from Vermont, he sent me this great photo of him before he checked into Gurney's. He was driving a Mercedes convertible. The beauty of working in the FBI is that you're allowed to drive cars that are forfeited or taken in crimes, and you're able to repurpose them for undercover reasons. But he kind of looks like a playboy in this photo. And so when he checked at the Gurney's, he did so saying, he's saying that he was a real estate developer. He was there looking at nearby properties. And then a few other agents, they're all dressed like they were there for a nice, a nice stay, wearing shorts and t-shirts. But
how many from the mafia were there?
None. At the moment, no one showed up. The cut to the chase. So, and that was going to be my question for you. So there was about a week of kind of high stakes, very tense waiting, false alarms. And so ultimately they decided to pull the plug after a week when it was clear from Mr. Buckley's informant that despite his assurances that the meeting was going to happen, it didn't come to pass, at least during that week. And what was funny is around that time, the Brookhaven National Lab was having its linear accelerator conference around the same time. And it was kind of interesting bit of history. It was the first time that China had sent linear accelerator scientists to the United States to attend a scientific conference. And so unbeknownst to these agents, there was a lot of Cold War intrigue happening around the same time while they were waiting for the mafia to arrive. But
and then the mafia finally did arrive.
Well, they definitely met. That is unclear. They definitely met many years following. John Gotti would often have meetings there with other members of different families. In fact, Joe Schiappone, I had interviewed Mr. Schiappone's nephew, and Joe was evidently a silent investor at Gurney's when Nick Monte bought it in the 50s. And Joe Schiappone was with the Genovese family, and he had pretty much ruled all of sanitation and private carding in Brooklyn. But he would meet with Gotti and others in the years that would follow. In fact, there's a great photo from Mr. DiMatteo's book that we didn't use here for the story, but it's of Frank DiMatteo, Joe Schiappone, and others at a New Year's party at Gurney's in 1980. So.
Well, remembering back to that era for me, I couldn't have said that this was that meeting. I could only say that there were meetings, and Nick Monti was never in the mafia. He was a restaurateur. It was the Venetian Room was a very famous, as you said, very famous place in the city. And he said, I can't, you know, I don't control where anybody's going to come for a vacation. And that could happen from time to time. But there was a time when there was a lot of them had come out to Montauk for a confab of that kind. And mm-hmm. it was, and as a result of that, Nick Monti afterwards actually wrote a letter that was appeared in the East Hampton Star newspaper saying that he wanted to be clear if any of these rumors are flying around that the mob was out and these people were there, but that he had nothing to do with that. He was a family member by birth and knew them, and they came to his restaurant and so forth and so on. So that was the limit of my recollection to what happened. But Gurney's Inn is a huge installation on the cliff. I think there must be 10 different buildings, including a spa. There wasn't a spa back then. It's a place where you could have some meeting like that because of the privacy was there to be had, since there were about a dozen different rooms and cottages and motels area and dining rooms and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So what was there ever any connection between these two groups that you wanted to talk about?
Yeah, so I think, you know, for the Bureau, that factored into their thinking, was that it was remote, it was by the ocean, it offered some seclusion. Around that time, it was September 79, Gurney's had just opened the spa, which was like $4 million. And the, you know, to Monti's credit, he was able to, and this dates back to when he opened up the rest, bought the hotel. He expanded into a convention space, hence the Linear Accelerator Conference. And so, you know, that it operated year round and was very profitable that way. And so when Bob Shortle, who was the agent I was telling you about, who looked like a playboy, when he arrived there, he kind of looked at it, and to him, he was surveying the grounds, and it made sense to him that they would do it, and yet it didn't, because it was somewhat porous, and it was fairly easy for them, them being the FBI, to keep eyes on the mob. Now, in my thinking, maybe 20/20 hindsight, the benefit of being a Gurney's and holding a meeting of that magnitude there is that you're able to see who's there. If, you know, and so if you spot the 40 agents trying to blend in and seem like they're tourists, yeah, I think that ultimately, you know, you're able to you know, abort the meeting, and
that's what happened.
Mm-hmm. So my guess is that's probably what happened. They kind of stuck out like a sore thumb.
Yeah. They came. Did they wire it up with microphones?
They wired it up with microphones. So they had there was an agent named H. Edward Tickle. That was his actual name. Who was this? You know, he was considered the preeminent black bag guy. And those guys are the ones who were able to, you know, break into any room, pick any lock, and install recording devices in kind of surreptitious places. H. Edward Tickle was also notorious for, around that time, he was charged with transporting stolen diamonds that he tried to fence. And for giving Richard Petty, who's the NASCAR driver, for giving his team FBI radios. Ultimately, you know, Tickle, despite being very good at his job, was fired and did time in prison. But his whole skill was impressioning, which is basically taking the blank key, kind of, you know, jiggering it around and filing it down. And in the kind of the dark of night at Gurney's, he was going to each room and creating an impression in keys of all the main conference rooms, hotel rooms, everything. So he effectively, and they installed a few recording devices in at least one of the conference rooms. And the challenge with that is they had to get it had to be legally approved as a Title III recording. And so because they didn't know who was going to be there, where the exact location of the meeting was going to be, which is what you typically need for Title III, it was one of the very rare instances where the Department of Justice and the courts granted them an emergency provision where you can install it. Then after the meeting happens, you can get the approval.
Nice vacation for the weekend.
It is. Well, I don't think it was for them. It was sort of like sitting around waiting and waiting and waiting and stressed. And I think, the people who made off the best was actually Nick Monte and Gurney's themselves, because I think the FBI spent something north of $40,000 on the entire thing, on all rooms and food and everything else. They had approved it as a major operation. Now, granted, it was, they were somewhat over-earnest. Over-eager, rather, but
maybe 5 or 6 names of mafia types that would expect that people might recognize.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, Castellano, Frank Funzie Terry, Carmine the Snake Persico, Santos Traficante. There's a belief that maybe some guys from New England, the Patriarca family, would come. So they were expecting the bosses, if not them, the underbosses as well.
You said from out of town, was that?
So Patriarchas ran most of organized crime in New England. Santos Traficante, he operated out of Florida. He pretty much ran all of Tampa. So, and I think again, for the Bureau, they're like, all right, well, we cannot not take a chance on this. It could happen, it could not, but if we missed out on the meeting of that potential, we'd be kicking ourselves for a long while.
Tell me about how you got into this kind of journalism. Are you a Long Islander? Were you born and raised out here?
No, I was born in London, raised in New York City. Grew up going out to East Hampton. My parents still go out there quite a bit. My wife and I, we were in Montauk every summer. Our kids go to camp out there. So I grew up in the area. When I was interviewing these agents for a separate project, these FBI agents, when they told me about Gurney's, it instantly, because obviously I knew of Gurney, grew up going out to Gurney's and knew of its history. And so, and I had never heard the story reported before. And so, it just sort of kind of piqued my interest being familiar with the area, familiar with how are they able to survey that entire area when, if you're following the mob car down 27, to Old Montauk Highway, you're going to get spotted almost instantly. So, that kind of just having that familiarity with the area really was what drew me to the story.
What do you like to do when you're out here?
Well, I have kids, so I'm at their mercy. I think, having lunch at Westlake Fish House is good enough for me. Taking my kids to the beach and, taking them to Ditch. We stay at Ditch Plains every summer. Gurney's is certainly a lot fancier these days and a different kind of beast than it was when I grew up. And same thing with Duryea's. I grew up going out to Duryea's, so that was my favorite place. And that's certainly, been refurbished, to say the least. So, yeah.
Well, thank you for being on the podcast and teaching us a little bit about Montauk fit into history in a way I never knew. Well, I knew about it, but I never knew about the FBI making a film. This would make a good movie, it seems to me.
We're working on that. So, yeah. That's the next step. But a last question for you, though, actually was just what was Nick Monte like? I know you had known him and, just sort of how would you describe Monte as a personality?
He was a handsome, a little overweight. He, when he talked, you could count on what he said as being so. And he never, I've never heard or seen him lose his temper. He was a real leader in the community and well respected. And then everybody on the side was thinking, well, he's sort of in a pickle because he comes from this family. And I don't think anyone thought he was a member of the mafia, but just in the back of his minds. As time went on, the spa became a heavy burden for the inn, and eventually they had to bring in timeshare people, and that created a whole. I was one of the people. I swapped an ad at that time for Christmas in a room, which I used a couple of times, and then went off using it and swapping it elsewhere around the world. But I worried about it, and eventually the banks caught up with him, and they he had to try and deal now with the timeshare people were actually in the majority, and the majority owners was little known. So the quality of the care there went down because these timeshare people didn't know how to run the place, and they hired Nick and his family to do it until actually a New Yorker, a big developer, came in who had been summering in Montauk, as you probably know, and made a deal with the timeshare people, and then came and took over and made it into this amazing place. I think a night at the inn went from about $80 a night to $1,000 a night.
Checks out. Yeah.
Thanks for being on the podcast.
Yeah, absolutely. It was great to meet you. Thank you, guys.